So we're going to, believe it or not, we're going to be coming up until Canto 4, Chapter 22. At least I'm going to try.
Chapter
4. Right, text 22. What I think is going to happen is all the material will not get covered. I mean, I don't think we're going to cover the whole first canto. And I got some idea of that, and then also some feedback from the class that it'd be nice to have more discussion. And just to blaze through the information, I can give the storyline for sure, but discussing the topics is where the real nectar is, so we'll see how it goes this way. Few questions first. Did everyone here in the room, by show of hands, did you see that little yellow piece of paper on the board with the homework assignment? No.
Yes.
Okay, those of you that saw it, were you able to complete it?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll try to get to that part of the discussion today, and that can be also the homework for tomorrow. I think you can also write something, and that this is homework, so you can, those of you that like to write things down, we can apply the same to Vyasadeva's realization. Of course, the stages will be a little more spread out to the text of Bhagavatam. In other words, Vyasadeva's state of realization comes much later, because we're going to be hearing today something about Vyasadeva's appearance and the early stages of his activity and so on. And so, but it's particularly appropriate, let's say, it's very clearly appropriate in each of the steps to Narada and his realization, because although Narada in this life is an incarnation empowered with bhakti shakti to spread devotional service, Vyasadeva is an incarnation from his appearance, very early incarnation. In any event, I'd like to start by looking at one particular verse in the third chapter, and then we'll kind of spread around through the chapter. So chapter 3, text 31, which is on page 180. Chapter 3, text 31. This verse translates, "Clouds and dust are carried by the air, but less intelligent persons say that the sky is cloudy or the air is dirty. Similarly, they also implant material bodily conception on the spirit self." Everyone find that place? Page 180. So, in the chapter, the points I'd like to make about the chapter. One is that there are misconceptions that are imposed both on Krishna and on the Jiva soul. So a simile is helping us to understand those misconceptions. One way to understand the misconception is, it's not that clouds don't exist and dust don't exist, but to say that the clouds are in the air, the fact is the clouds are in to say the sky is cloudy, more precisely, water vapor is carried in the air. And also the dust. So that the air is dirty, but the air has dirt particles. In other words, so language is less than precise, and because language is less than precise, perception is also, the real fact of the matter is that the soul is more subtle than the bodily conception, gross or subtle. The reason I picked this particular verse is we'll look backwards just a bit. Text 30 is saying that the Virata Rupa is presented as an imaginary conception of God for persons who are so materialistic they can't have any other conception of God than that which is of gross matter. Therefore, the Virat Rupa is there. But text 30 is indicating that Virat Rupa is not one of the incarnations listed in this chapter 3, texts 5 through 27. Are a list of some of the incarnations. So Virat Rupa is not in that list. Why not? Because it's a gross material presentation, an idea meant for persons who are so base in their self-conception that that's all that they can relate to is something base. But the real form, when we're hearing descriptions of the incarnations, the point is being made in this little section, those incarnations should be understood as more subtle, as much as, now text 31, as much as it's not a fact that the sky is cloudy or the air is dirty. Just have to also move the position.
Sorry.
Just a little. Keeps everybody awake. That's it. No one will fall asleep there. Our kitchen man and Subal's our sound man. Cook a great lunch. One of the nicest parts of the Institute is, of course, his nice cooking. So, this whole section that goes from 29. Almost to the end, to 39, 29 to 39, is discussing overall, it's tying together several of the answers to the sages. One of the topics the sages were asking about, what about the science of Godhead? In other words, what about the mystery of the Lord's appearance? And what is the best all-around good for everyone in all circumstances? Those three. So question one, we're saying the answer to that question is hearing the topics of the personality of Godhead. So what's so special? What happens when one hears the topic? Because everyone, as we heard at the beginning chapter, everyone is hearing and chanting about something. The birds, and the people on Wall Street, and every materialist, and this hearing and chanting process is not a foreign process. So what's so special about topics of Krishna? So that science is being described here. As the Lord is subtle, beyond bodily conception and beyond the subtle factors of the mind also, that those topics, when properly heard and chanted, take one to that region. The science is being explained. And therefore further establishing the glories of the process of hearing and chanting. So now looking forward a little bit, I'm reading text 32. Beyond this gross conception of form is another subtle conception of form, which is without formal shape and unseen, unheard and unmanifest. That's the subtle body. So now here's another very important point. The living being is beyond that. Krishna is also beyond. So then the next verse is saying one can realize both the self and God by being beyond those gross and subtle material conceptions. The incarnations, which have been already listed, we're working, going to work backwards in this chapter to keep you all on your toes. These incarnations that already have been described briefly, they're like the self, beyond material conceptions, subtle and gross. Now, a very important verse is verse 34. We're going to refer back to this also, so please look at it. If the illusory energy subsides and the living entity becomes fully enriched with knowledge by the grace of the Lord, then he becomes at once enlightened with self-realization and becomes situated in his own glory. Now this has a lot to do with a lot of different topics in the Bhagavatam, in this first canto Bhagavatam, even things that we've covered already. So one is how to overcome the influence. As I said, a lot of what follows from the first chapter is the explanation of process, or how to, abhideya. So in this how to, the science is also being taught that the very same energy, the illusory energy that's covering the living entity in darkness of ignorance, that very same energy subsides and acts in a different way to enrich the living entity with knowledge. Very same energy, Prabhupada makes it very clear. Very clear. Very same energy. Even he has one sentence in the purport that's very startling. He says, this is the third sentence in the purport, text 34. The same energy acts as his external, internal, and marginal energies. And by his omnipotency, he can perform anything and everything through the agency of any of the above energies. He can turn the external energy into internal energy by his will. So what is it that enthuses, as the verse says, or enriches the living entity with knowledge? It's the same energy that covers the living entity with ignorance, only the Lord's transforming it. This is illuminating the whole idea of hearing and discussing the topics of Krishna. Question one, or the answer to question one. Hearing the topics of Sri Krishna illumines, whereas the same energy, when the living entity is not engaged in that hearing and chanting process, same energy acts to bewilder the living entity, to have the living entity foolishly and falsely think that I am the grosser self-covering, and therefore the process of jnana and karma become more preferred. So this is question one, is, as we commented yesterday, is very much tied in with question two. What is it that all scripture is indicating as the best activity, form of dharma? Devotional service. By properly hearing and chanting, the attraction of devotion awakens. And then he becomes at once enlightened with self-realization. So, and then becomes situated in his own glory. So what your homework assignment was requesting for you to analyze Narada's realization, it's capsulized right here also. The stages aren't drawn out and spelled out, but the same process is described. The next verse is also a clue to understanding what's going to come up in the latter chapters, next two or three chapters of the Bhagavatam. That is, learned men describe births and activities of the unborn and inactive, which is undiscoverable even in Vedic literatures. So Vyasadeva had compiled the Vedic literatures, and he was still feeling not satisfied. He still hadn't, reading the text of the verse, he hadn't discovered the undiscoverable. Certainly, Vyasadeva knew perfectly well the personality of Godhead and the science of the personality of Godhead. But the process of speaking those glories is what manifests the personality of Godhead, because it awakens one's devotion. Clear? You got it, Akhilada? Yes.
So as far as him speaking it, isn't the Srimad Bhagavatam primarily conversations that have already spoken previously?
Yeah.
So him compiling it, just put it together from perhaps it was scattered and...
No, no, not exactly. There's one text where Prabhupada in the beginning of chapter 4, we'll go over it again when we get there, but Prabhupada specifically indicates that unlike the Vedas, which are a compilation of something that already existed, he just divided it, Bhagavatam itself is original commentary. Now I wanted to make a concluding point, which I'll make now, because it's appropriate. That is, in the course of preparing, for so many hours sitting up there in my room, I'm appreciating very much the message, in a practical sense, of Prabhupada's purports. In other words, simply looking at the verses as somebody who didn't have the advantage of having Prabhupada's purports, you get the storyline, but you don't get the meaning. So, Vyasadeva compiled the Vedas, but the commentary is really what tells you what the meaning of the Vedas are. And Srimad Bhagavatam is that original commentary. It's not simply, like you said, a compilation of already structured conversations, which, yes, it's conversations that already took place, but it's presented as a form of commentary. And then the Vedic process is, one who speaks the Srimad Bhagavatam also must explain it. So Srila Prabhupada's purports are there. And according to the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that these purports or commentary is as good as the original text. It's specifically meant for us. Srila Prabhupada's purports are meant for us in this age. English-speaking places in the world, which he was assigned or directed to do by his spiritual master. But that was what Vyasadeva was also trying to do. The all-around good for, we'll hear in the fourth chapter, his despondency was following behind such a strong desire to do good for all of humanity in this age. He needed to do the specific glorification. So using this language, discovering the undiscoverable. This particular verse 35 also addresses the question number 3. I don't want to belabor the point and necessarily bring it up every time it comes up. I'm just hinting at the point that this theme of questions and answers, the original questions of the Bhagavatam, surface again and again and again consistently. So the third question was, can you explain to us the mysterious appearance of the Lord and the purpose of it? So he's giving some indication. Thus learned men describe the birth and activities of the unborn and inactive. It's a contradiction. Birth and activities of the unborn and inactive. They're transcendental. When we hear of them, we should understand they're not fictitious or imagination, but they're transcendental activities. Another proof of their transcendental activities is described in the next couple of verses, that is, by hearing them, it takes one to that position of transcendence. Ready for Ramana? Just stretch it. Okay. So the last four verses of this chapter, they're dealing with the glories of the Bhagavatam. The glories of Srimad Bhagavatam, these four verses, they're preparing the way. I'm going to surprise you and go after this, go back to the first part of the chapter. But it's preparing the way for the next chapter, chapter 4, where questions about Sukadeva start. The very end of the chapter is giving the answer to the last question. Where are Vidita's principles now taking shelter? Text 43. Chapter 3, text 43. They've taken shelter in the Bhagavatam. And people in this age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. So the glories of the Bhagavatam are specifically mentioned. It's the spotless Purana. In the verses, verse 40 is called Brahma Samhita, which means it's a literary incarnation of Krishna. It's very special because it's compiled by Vyasa himself. Then another another term in text 40, Nikshrayasya, that is meant for the ultimate good of everyone. So the ultimate good of everyone is another question that very, when you hear that term, a little bell should go off in your head saying, oh, this is one of the questions asked by the sages of Naimisharanya. What is the ultimate and absolute good for everyone? So that's Srimad Bhagavatam, Nikshrayasya. And the next verse is indicating that it should be heard from the person the person Bhagavat. The book Bhagavat should be heard from the person Bhagavat. So the beginning of the next chapter then starts describing what are the qualifications, once again, the qualifications of the speaker, the qualifications of the hearer of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So I'm spilling over already into chapter 4. The qualifications of the hearer and speaker, they've already been discussed in a philosophy form very, very early in the first chapter. Now it's being presented in a story form. The philosophy is now just being made more palatable by narrating the story. But before even the story, we have questions, because that's the format of the Bhagavatam. So the questions are coming from Shonaka, where Shonaka is asking, this is very wonderful. How is it that Vyasadeva, after compiling the Vedas, was feeling some despondency? And what inspired him to write a commentary on what he had already written? And how was it that Maharaj Pariksit met Sukadeva Goswami? Tell us about all these things. So in the course of those types of narrations, it's describing the appearance, in one sense, the appearance of Srimad Bhagavatam, because we just heard about it at the end of chapter 3. Now, the appearance of Srimad Bhagavatam comes because the equivalent of Srimad Bhagavatam personified comes in the form of Sukadeva. Sukadeva's appearance means the Bhagavatam's appearance. So Shonaka is asking about Sukadeva Goswami. They have some description of his transcendental qualities are narrated. And then they want to know about the person who heard. What are the glories of Sukadeva and what are the glories of Maharaj Pariksit? The glories of the hearer. He represents the personified perfect hearer. Why is he the perfect hearer? So I understand this was one of the questions in the Krishna book class. Also, what was very special about Maharaj Pariksit? Why was he such a qualified hearer? Well, certainly one thing was there, that he knew he was about to die. That made a big difference. But he was a transcendentalist who knew he was about to die. So that he had some familial relation with Krishna also. But he was a transcendentalist. Not simply based upon familial tie, was Maharishi Pariksit concerned. So he was a transcendental hearer. The questions in this chapter indicate that. They ask a very, very nice question, very prodding question. That Maharishi Pariksit was such a transcendental emperor that his very body was the place of shelter of the whole world. So when his body was in danger, why didn't he do something to protect his body, to allow that shelter to continue for those who he was sacrificing everything in his service for Krishna for, to allow that shelter to continue? So the question is alluding to an interest that Maharishi Pariksit had as a sense of duty beyond the execution even of his varna and ashram requirements. This is a theme of the Bhagavatam also. This hearing the message of the personality of Godhead is the ultimate duty. So apply that in a practical sense, that sometimes our devotees, due to lack of attraction for spiritual topics, will be very eager to neglect their hearing in favor of some other practical activity that needs to take place. So not advocating being irresponsible in things that need to take place. But priority has to be there, that hearing is such an important activity that if for some reason sacrifice of hearing takes place in one circumstance, the hearing has to take place in another circumstance. Hearing is of such great importance that Maharishi Pariksit was willing to give up his body, and which meant the protection of all the citizens of the planet. As a royal king, as a God-realized king, for another purpose that Krishna wanted to fulfill, that was, he was, his primary attachment was to Krishna's will and hearing topics about Krishna. So there's one other comment made, interesting comment made in text 13 of chapter 4, that is, it's kind of a cultural comment, but the sages, or Shonaka specifically, addresses Sutta as one who is very well versed in all the Vedas, almost. So the almost part is that he was an expert in reciting the Vedic hymns. He didn't have that skill of knowing the meters and accents, which are necessary in certain parts of ritualistic sacrifices found within the Vedas. Because he was far, his expertise was different. His expertise was, he had realized the conclusions, which is more important. They're indirectly, not so indirectly, indirectly, but not so indirectly, indicating that this is far more important, because all those persons who were assembled there, they were the ones expert in the ritualistic processes of the Vedas, but they wanted to hear from Sutta. Because Sutta is the one that knew the purpose behind it all, having heard it from Shukadeva. So, this is another statement about the qualification of speaker. So I want to repeat my point, that up to this stage, and we'll hear more of it, but up to this stage, a lot of emphasis is there on the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam, the qualification of one to present the Bhagavatam, the necessary qualification to hear it properly, so there's actually some fruit or fulfillment of that hearing activity that comes out. And we'll, as the next part of this little dialogue goes on, its points are represented again. The little dialogue that goes on is, so up to text 13 in chapter 4, it's just questions, text 1 to 13. It's in the form of questions of the sages to Sutta. And Sutta starts to answer in text 14. So from text 14 to 25, he begins text 14 with explaining or just mentioning the birth of Vyasadeva, one verse only. And this is standard. It's an important in Vedic literature, in traditional Vedic literature, to state one's gotra, one's position of birth, because as you recall, that's one of the six questions, also the sages. They want to know the transcendental nature of Krishna's birth. Not just who his mother and father were and what his family lineage was. What's the transcendental mystery behind the appearance of Krishna? So, the appearance of Vyasadeva is mentioned, and then the next verse right away, he's mature, he's an adult, and the description is there given, narrated by Sutta about what he did. That right through verse 25, his compiling of the four Vedas, dividing them into four, entrusting them to different servants, different disciples. To further benefit the people in general, he compiles Mahabharata. And then he gets to a point where even after compiling Mahabharata, which means Bhagavad Gita, he's feeling despondency. So the next group of verses, he then starts thinking within himself, more or less reviewing the same thing that has already been said. The literary effect is, it's just repeating for clear understanding and for recollection. He repeats within his own thinking process. Why am I feeling despondency? I did this, my following is proper, my understanding is complete, and I've compiled it all, my motivation was for the welfare of everyone. I made it very easy by Mahabharata, and because it's simply presented in story form, people in this age should be able to understand, yet I'm feeling despondency. In other words, just as the sages who were assembled there, they had faith, you mentioned this, that by performing a sacrifice for the pleasure of Vishnu, this would be the watering of the root of the tree and everything would flourish. So Vyasadeva certainly has that same faith, and I'm not feeling the flourishing. Where's the satisfaction? I'm feeling dissatisfied. So this sets the ground. One, it sets the ground for Narada's appearance. Very timely, Narada appears. It also sets the ground for a very important discussion that's near and dear to everybody. That is, how can I attain satisfaction? And then the reverse side is, how can I get rid of dissatisfaction or despondency? That's the topic of the beginning of the fifth chapter. How one can experience genuine satisfaction, how one can rid oneself of despondency. Now, who is there that doesn't have that kind of concern? I wanted to make a couple other comments also. And that is, look at verse 26 of this chapter, verse 4. Still his mind was, twice born Brahmana, still his mind was not satisfied, although he engaged himself in working for the total welfare of all people. So I want to make a particular point about how two verses are helping us to understand what might be a little bit bewildering otherwise. In the second chapter, verse 33, please look. It says, the Supersoul enters into the bodies of all created beings who are influenced by the modes of material nature and causes them to enjoy the effects of these modes by the subtle mind. So this is nearly at the end of chapter 2. And this notion is also carrying over into chapter 3 and then into chapter 4. Vyasadeva's mind was not satisfied. So the text is saying it's the Supersoul who causes that. I mentioned this when we covered chapter 2 yesterday. The Supersoul causes the feeling of despondency within the mind. It's like the interface between the material energy and the living entity. So Supersoul is that interface, and he works through the mind for happiness and suffering. Way up into the 11th canto, where Krishna is instructing Uddhava, the same point comes in another story form, so many places throughout the Bhagavatam, that the mind is actually a resting place of this worldly suffering or happiness. It's all illusory. So now the verse that I drew your attention to in chapter 3, that is text 34, says, by the same super soul's arrangement, the illusory suffering subsides, or the attraction for illusory happiness also subsides. The mad chasing after illusory happiness and trying to get away from material suffering subsides by the arrangement of super soul specifically. The previous verse, the 32, I believe it is. Anyway, this section says he enters within every living being. So it's super soul who transforms that illusory suffering or attraction for enjoyment into a transcendental enjoyment, which comes from hearing transcendental topics. I'm trying to point out that the science of this process of hearing is described within the pages of the Bhagavatam. Persons who criticize and say, oh, this is just this, they may not say it, the Vedantists and the scholars, the speculative scholars, but we know that this is how they think, because it's in their writing, that this devotional literature is just for foolish people that can't manage to get it together to have enough intelligence to study the Vedas. And so these other literatures are prepared to just more or less pacify them and humor them. And their whole idea of worshipping of deities and so on is another of the same type of thing. Etc., etc. Other kinds of offensive ideas. So the science is being explained. Why is it that Vyasadeva, what to speak of ourselves, who are trying to become devotees, Vyasadeva here is also experiencing despondency within his mind. He's not satisfied. Why? That's being arranged, the whole, it's lila. It's being arranged by Super Soul in order for Shukadeva Goswami to enter and deliver the whole message of Srimad Bhagavatam to Vyasadeva. It's also instructive. Prabhupada uses this explanation elsewhere, that Krishna instructs the conditioned souls by instructing his own devotee. And Prabhupada gives the explanation, just like there's a Bengali saying that the mother instructs the daughter-in-law by instructing her own daughter. So Krishna instructs the conditioned soul by instructing his own devotee. Or in this case, Narada is instructing Vyasadeva for our, the purpose of our instruction. Why is it that our mind will not feel distance, feel proper satisfaction? Even so many things we may try to do in the right way. What is the root cause of that despondency? And we hear it in the very beginning of chapter 5. Narada makes a pretty sarcastic comment to Vyasadeva, almost like a put down. Addressing Vyasadeva, the son of, this is chapter 5, text 2. Are you satisfied by identifying with the body or the mind as the object of self-realization? I mean, in other words, it's pretty elementary. Haven't you gone beyond that elementary stage? Are you not satisfied by identifying the body or the mind as the object of self-realization? So, I said that we'll stop at text 22. So between here and 22, Narada also recounts the qualification of Vyasadeva. It makes it very clear in what happened in the previous part of the fourth chapter and out here in the fifth chapter. What are the qualifications for what are Vyasadeva's good qualifications, and very specifically, what was it that he was lacking in? that was the cause of his despondency. All of the benefits, Vyasadeva says in the previous chapter, all the benefits in that one can attain from the Vedas, he was fully equipped with. What to speak of anyone who's the follower of the Vedas, how can they even expect to be as qualified as Vyas? Then in text, looking back now, text 31 in chapter 3 is like a key verse also. Vyas hints at, perhaps it's because I didn't specifically point out the devotional service to the Lord. For this devotional service, this is one of the questions, so it's getting the spotlight. And a further discussion in chapter 5, that will also get the spotlight from Narada, who is the bearer of devotion, bhakti. There's a nice discussion, say, around verses 16 to 22, making a comparison between any type of literature, even Vedic literature or God-related literature, that doesn't specifically glorify the name, form, quality, and pastimes of the personality of Godhead. That which does not do that will leave one still feeling dissatisfied. So, now I'm going to make a full circle back around to the beginning of chapter 3, which is where we started from. We started somewhere in the middle of chapter 3. So now we'll, going back to the very beginning, I want to leave some time for discussion, so I'm doing it this way. The very beginning of chapter 3, there's a group of verses that are introducing points that will be elaborated on later. Chapter two ended by giving us something of the science of Godhead. Now the beginning, we're going to hear a lot about in chapter 3 the incarnations. So in preparation for those incarnations to be described, some idea of the material creation, as Gopi identified the terms for us, Sarga and Visarga. Now these are two essential topics that have to be discussed in a Purana. There are two different categories of Puranas, or three actually. But one is a regular Purana and another is a Mahapurana. Srimad Bhagavatam is Mahapurana. There have to be 10 topics. A regular Purana has to have 5. In both of them, they have to discuss Sarga and Disarga. Sarga means the detailed creation. I hope I don't have these terms backwards. One of them deals with the from Mahavishnu becoming forth of the Vishnu, the Mahatattva, and the glancing of Mahavishnu, bringing the living entities within the field of the material energy, the beginning appearance of Lord Brahma, and from that point then the other of the two. I'm not sure which is Sarga, which is Visarga.
The first is Sarga.
Huh?
The first is Sarga and the second is Sarga.
Okay, you're sure?
Yeah, it was said in class.
Yeah.
Okay. So, then when Lord Brahma appears, at the end of chapter 2, we heard about the Guna avatars. So now, two of the Guna avatars are described at the beginning of chapter 3. I'm making this point that for the showing the purpose that when a verse appears in the Bhagavatam, certain message is being said, but a certain preparation is for what's to come is also being accomplished. One of the qualities of Krishna is listed that with doing one thing, he's accomplishing many things. So Vyasadeva being a literary incarnation. There's a certain things, although it's not chronological, It's not haphazard either. The end of chapter 2 mentions the guna avatars. Then Visarga, Visarga is coming. Lord Brahma appears. The purpose of these incarnations is also briefly described. The concept of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva is introduced. It's not elaborately discussed. But the simultaneous oneness and difference of the Lord's creation with Himself, you can read that in those verses, is described. Then the list of incarnations come. From verses 5 through 27, simply a list, one after the other. And then 28, so we started our class from verse 30. So, and verse 28, this is called the principal statement of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's a very important verse.
328?
328. Where Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. According to Jiva Goswami, every scripture and every Vedic writing has a principal statement that summarizes the whole Vedic writing. This verse is that verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the purpose of the Bhagavatam is to reveal Krishna. And what is Krishna's position? Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam is identified. So Prabhupada indicates that very briefly in the purport, Jiva Goswami's appreciation of this verse, the importance of this verse. The four nutshell verses that Rabindra Sarup discussed in one of his classes here at the Institute are certainly essential verses of the Bhagavatam. From those four, all the verses have come. But the summary statement of them is also found in this one verse. Everything that exists has its source of emanation from Krishna, including the incarnations themselves, and all the energies of Krishna also. So now we did a full swing through those verses and through a portion of the Bhagavatam, which leaves us at chapter 5, text 23, which is the beginning of Narada's description to Vyas of his realization of transcendence. So I think what I'll do at this point is just open the floor for discussion, not so much on the homework, unless you want to discuss the homework particularly. Anything that we've covered in the discussion today. Mahendra?
Could you repeat again what you said a while back about when you're talking about the same energy does have one effect and another, a different effect when the process of hearing is taking place, you said the super soul transforms that something.
Yeah, super soul, it's chapter 3, text 34. That is, the same energy that has a living entity in the illusion state acts differently when that same living entity is engaged in the glorification of the Lord's activities and pastimes and appearance. That same energy acts enthuse or inspire the living entity with transcendental knowledge. Those pastimes have those potencies. The same energy then acts differently, just by having the opportunity to hear.
Can you explain the concept of interface
now? I've heard someone explain it. I don't know so much about computers. You know much about computers? No, that won't help. That's a computer term. But say, like a switchboard operator, someone on one side with their calling out their telephone call, and someone's on the other side to receive it. And that which is making the connection between one and the other. So there's the material energy, and there's the living entity. How is living? How is consciousness? Sariputta discusses this concept. How does consciousness connect with matter? The agency is supersoul. The supersoul acts through the mind. And so it's the in-between feature, connecting two things that appear to be disconnected.
So what was the Vedanta Sutra before it was quoted? I mean, the comment commented upon.
What was it?
Yeah.
Just codes. What before it was codes, it was in the more expanded form in the four Vedas, and before that in the original one Veda, which became four by Vyasa's dividing it into four.
So he's repeating so many conversations, and these conversations, they also give the ultimate conclusion and
yes.
speak about the devotional service and why there would be despondency, or you know, why did he have to expand upon it if it was already there?
Well, he hints at it. We can look at text 31 of chapter 3. He hints at it himself. And then Narada says it more specifically. Is it 31? Chapter 4, I'm sorry, 31. I'm feeling incomplete. Why is that? This may be because I did not specifically point out the devotional service of the Lord, which is dear both to perfect beings and to the infallible Lord. So in verses 6, in chapter 5, verses 16 through 22, there's a lot of discussion of what is the consequence of even spiritual literature, let's say the Vedic literature, which does not, portions of it that encourage and material involvement. Property mark, continuing on in the ways of enjoyment in the world while accruing some piety along the way. Engaging in some kind of sacrifice to get the object with the motivation, with the express motivation of getting the object of desired attainment while at the same time being religious about it. That leaves one in the position of despondency.
So in other words, these conversations were not reported before in the sutras.
There's no conversations in sutras. Sutras are just
right.
little short statements.
So this first canto, this occurred after Vyasadeva spoke to Sukadeva for the song yet. So how does that happen? You know, this is all written after that was all over. This is because they're describing what they heard. So
that means the Bhagavatam is moved up, discussed,
and it comes first. You know, what was there before the first canon?
I'm trying to understand what...
You know, this first
canon... Here's a chronology question.
Yeah.
So after Vedanta Sutra was compiled, the event that we're just reading about took place. The event that we're reading about was then later described by Sutta to the sages, Shonaka and company.
Right, but the Srimad Bhagavatam was already compiled before this.
I think I'm getting the question.
When the events happened and the stories were known, when they were compiled.
When Shukadeva Goswami spoke to Maharaj Pariksit, that was after this event that we're reading about took place.
Right.
So this event took place, Shukadeva spoke about it, and again Sutta spoke about it. The chronology is intact. Vedanta Sutra was written. Vyasadeva felt despondency. Narada appeared. Narada instructed him to write Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam was written. Shukadeva Goswami was instructed in Srimad Bhagavatam. Shukadeva Goswami narrated Srimad Bhagavatam to Maharaj Pariksit. Sutta Goswami heard it, and he explained it to the sages of Naimisharanya. Should I do it again?
Just so
that. Huh?
Half of it.
Okay. Which half?
The second half.
Okay.
All right, after...
After which point?
All right, after Shukadeva Swami, Maharaj
Pariksit. Okay. Shukadeva Swami heard in detail Srimad Bhagavatam from his father. Maharaj Pariksit is about to die. Shukadeva Goswami appears on the scene. He describes and narrates Srimad Bhagavatam, which he heard from his father. In the audience was Sutta. Sutta heard it. Sutta narrated it later to the sages of Naimisharanya. The linear chronology is there.
He's describing, he already spoke to Sukadeva Goswami.
Well, the person that we're hearing narrating here is Sutta.
Right. So we have this now.
Someone who heard from Sutta. Someone who heard the conversation between a third party, you can say. Between.
Vyasadeva wrote this conversation. He had written before.
So who is the scribe? That's what you want to know.
And how could it come before everything else? When it happened last, after it was finished.
Come before everything else after it was finished. I'm not sure I understand
you. How could it happen first when it was recorded after it already happened? That's because the person who compiled it had all that knowledge and put it first. Then how could it come first when, I don't know.
I think I know what you're saying. On the one hand, we're defining Srimad Bhagavatam as what Vyasadeva compiled. And on the other hand, we're considering everything within the two pages of this Srimad Bhagavatam. And they're not exactly necessarily the same. Because there's the incidents that happened after he compiled the Bhagavatam that are in this, is it?
And that's right, the Sutta Goswami speaking happened after Vyasadeva was speaking with Narada.
Do you see what she was saying?
I think so.
And so she's saying how did those
it's now recorded,
after
it's now recorded in a forum
and now it's part of the Bhagavatam.
The present manifestation.
Okay, I've heard different explanations for that, and I'm not... Bhagavad offered one last night. I didn't. He presented it to Rabindra, and Rabindra thought, oh, that's a reasonable possibility. One explanation is that Vyasadeva is pre-Kalakya.
Yeah, because just like in he records the conversation with Lord Krishna and Uddhava, and that had occurred yet, right, at that time as well.
Yeah, Krishna's departure is before.
Because Krishna,
Maharaj Pariksit became king after Krishna had departed.
Right, but Sukadeva was present before Krishna departed.
Krishna was present before Sukadeva departed. Yes.
No. Shukadeva was present before Krishna.
Because remember, because he wouldn't come out of his mother's womb.
I remember that.
And Krishna had to go and ask.
Right.
Bhagavatam
was.
All those other things are predicted in the Bhagavad Gita that hadn't happened.
The answer to that is pre-Kalakya. In one purport, let's see if I don't recall it in the first canto. In one purport, because I just read through the whole first canto recently. I don't recall reading that. I do recall reading that these seeming contradictions in chronology. Now I understand your question better, I think. Anyone else? Or guy?
You were describing the super soul. Is the cause of discordance for a collision.
He ranges for that discordance.
It seems like the super soul is then kind of
a bad guy.
Not a bad guy, but interferes with that free will.
No, exactly. According to the living entity's prior choices, they have a certain destiny due to them, and Supersoul arranges that destiny. A certain amount of suffering and a certain amount of enjoyment at the hands of the material energy. Someone else that hasn't raised their hand yet. Go ahead.
Could you Sarga Visharga real quick?
Yes, Sarga is the primary creation. That is, generating the material ingredients, the gross substances, and the Visarga is the detailed creation.
Okay.
Now the contractor.
There's a thing about after Brahma, up to Brahma, and then after Brahma.
That's right.
Brahma is in charge of Visarga.
Yes.
Glad you give the inference. If you have yesterday spoke to Narada Muni, Narada Muni spoke to Shiva, yesterday spoke to Shiva Goswami.